hate you. I don't think you've gone bad. A lot of people have fallen into the trap you did. People better than either of us. I said, the evil queen of fairy trap?
Christ, Harry, Murphy said quietly.
No one just starts giggling and wearing black and signs up to become a villainous monster. How the hell do you think it happens? She shook her head, her eyes pained. It happens to people. Just people. They make questionable choices for what might be very good reasons. They make choice after choice. And none of them is slaughtering roomfuls of saints or murdering hundreds of baby seals or rubber room irrational. But it adds up. And then, one day, they look around and realize that they're so far over the line that they can't remember where it was. I looked away from her. Something in my chest hurt. I didn't say anything. Do you understand that? She asked me, her voice even more quiet. Do you understand how treacherous the ground you're standing on has become? Perfectly, I said. She nodded a few times, then she said, I suppose that's something. That all? I asked her. I mean, is that the only reason you came in here? Not quite, she said. You don't trust me, I said. Her eyes didn't meet mine, and didn't avoid them either. That will depend largely on the next few minutes. I inhaled through my nose and out again, trying to stay calm, clear, even. Okay, I said. What do you want me to do?
The skull, she said. I know what it is. So does Butters. And it's too powerful to be left in the wrong hands.
Meaning mine? I asked.
I'll tell you what I know. I know you broke into his house when he was at work and took it. I know you left Andy with cuts and bruises. And I know you wrecked the place a bit along the way.
You think that means I've gone bad?
She tilted her head slightly to one side as if considering. I think you were probably operating under some kind of harebrained lone hero rationale. Let's say that I'm concerned that you have enough things to juggle already. I thought about snapping at her, but she had a point.
Bob was a resource far too powerful to be allowed to fall into the hands of anyone who wouldn't use him responsibly. And I'd been doing the winter night gig full speed for about 12 hours, and I'd already had some disturbing realizations about myself. 12 hours? What would I be like after 12 days? 12 months. What if Karen was right and Mab got to me slow? Or worse, what if I was just human? She was right about that, too. Power corrupts, and the people being corrupted never seem to be aware that it's happening. I just told Butters that I wasn't magically bulletproof. What kind of arrogant ass would I be if I assumed I was morally infallible? That I would be wise and smart and savvy enough to avoid the pitfalls of power, traps that had turned better people than me into something horrible. I didn't want her to be right. I didn't like the idea at all. But denial is for children. I had to be a grown-up. Okay, I said, my throat tight. Bob's in that satchel out in the living room. Give him back to Butters.
Thank you, she said. I found where you left the swords.
She meant the two swords of the cross, two of the three holy blades meant to fill the hands of the righteous in the battle against true evil. I'd wound up babysitting them, being their custodian. Mostly they'd sat around in my place gathering dust. Yeah, I said.
I know how powerful they are, she said, and I know how vulnerable they are in the wrong hands. I'm not telling you where they are. I'm not giving them back to you. I'm not negotiating.
I exhaled slowly. A slow, hard anger rolled into a knot in my guts.
Those were my responsibility, I said.
They were, she said. There was something absolutely rigid in her blue eyes. Not anymore. The room suddenly felt too hot. Suppose I disagree.
Suppose you do, she said. What would you do if you were in my position?
I don't remember moving.
I just remember slamming the heel of my hand into the door 6 inches from the side of Karen's head. It sounded like a gunshot and left me standing over her, breathing harder, and the difference in our sizes was damn near comical. If I wanted to, I could wrap my fingers almost all the way around her throat. Her neck would break if I squeezed. She didn't flinch. She didn't move. She looked up at me and waited. It hit me. What I was thinking. What my instincts were screaming at me to do, and I suddenly sagged, bowing my head. My breath came out in uneven jerks. I closed my eyes, tried to get it under control. And then she touched me. She rested her hand lightly on my battered forearm, moving carefully, as if I were made of glass. Her fingers slid down my arm to my hand. She took it gently and lowered it, not trying to force anything. Then she took my right hand in her left. We stood that way for a moment, our hands clasped, our heads bowed. She seemed to understand what I was going through. She didn't push me. She just held my hands and waited until my breathing had steadied again. "Harry," she said quietly then, "do you want my trust?" I nodded tightly, not trusting myself to speak. "Then you're going to have to give me some. I'm on your side. I'm trying to help you. Let it go." I shuddered. "Okay," I said. Her hands felt small and warm in mine. "We've been friends a long time," I said, "since that troll on the bridge." "Yes." My eyes blurred up, stupid things, and I closed them. "I know I've screwed up," I said. "I'm going to have to live with that. But I don't want to lose you." In answer, Murphy lifted my right hand and pressed it against her cheek. I didn't open my eyes. I couldn't hear it in her voice or her breathing, but I felt a slight dampness touch my hand. "I don't want to lose you either," she said. "That scares me." I didn't trust myself to speak for a long time. She lowered my hands slowly and very gently let me go. Then she turned to the door. "Karen," I said, "what if you're right? What if I change? I mean, go really bad?" She looked back enough for me to see her profile and a quiet, sad smile. "I work with a lot of monsters these days." Chapter 28. I picked up another jacket hanging in the closet, an old surplus military garment with an 80s-style camouflage pattern. Not because I thought I would get cold as much as because I figured maybe the extra pockets would be handy if I found anything for which they would be needed. I didn't have any money or ID. I didn't have a credit card. Hell, I didn't have a business card. What would it say? "Harry Dresden, winter night, target slain. No barbecues, water slides, or fireworks displays." I could joke around with myself all I wanted, but I would be doing it only because I didn't want to face a larger question, a really hard one. How the hell did I put my life back together? Assuming I could do it at all. Fortunately, I had dire evil to fight at the moment, which meant that I could think about the life thing later. Thank God for imminent doomsday. I'd hate to have to face up to the really tough stuff so soon after getting back into the game. I heard the front door of the apartment open and close and some quiet talk. I came out of the bedroom to find that Molly had returned. Toot Toot was riding along on one of her shoulders, hanging on to the top rim of her ear to keep his balance. He looked none the worse for wear. "Molly?" "Harry," Molly said, smiling. "You look better. How do you feel?" "I'll do," I said. "Major General, I see you're back on your feet. The last time I saw you, I figured you'd be down for weeks." Toot stiffened to attention and threw me a salute.
"No, my lord. The little folk don't have time to waste weeks and weeks healing like you big people."
That probably shouldn't have surprised me. I'd seen Toot literally eat half his weight in pizza, and his wings were powerful enough to lift him off the ground into flight. Anything that can put food away that quickly and produce such a prodigious amount of physical power relative to its size must have a ridiculously high burning metabolism. And with the day I'd been having, it did my heart good to see him upright again. "Where are we on our scouts?" I asked Molly. "They're in a food coma," she said. "I ordered 20 pizzas. Must have been 500 of them in the parking lot. They'll be ready to go as soon as you tell me where you want them to look."
"I need a map," I said.
Molly reached into her back pocket and produced a folded map.
"Way ahead of you, boss."
"Soon as they're done, lay it out on the table," I said.
"Got it."
"Major General, I'm glad you're here," I said. "I need you to stay close." Toot saluted again and his wings blurred into motion, lifting him up off Molly's shoulder.
"Yes, my lord. What is the mission?"
"To prevent a prisoner from attempting escape," I said. "I captured Captain Hook."
"Sort of," Karen chimed in, her voice amused. She'd returned to her seat by the fireplace. I gave her a look.
"We have him. He's captured. That's the main thing."
Toot put his hand on his sword.
"Shall I dispatch him for you, my lord?"
he asked eagerly.
"Because I totally can."
"If it needs to be done," I said soberly, "I'll make sure it's your hand that does it. But we'll give him a chance to talk first."
"You are a man of mercy and grace, my lord,"
Toot Toot said, clearly disappointed. "You bet your ass," I said. "Make sure you're in a good spot to stop our guest from leaving."
"Aye,"
Toot said, saluting, and darted across the apartment. Molly shook her head.
"You're always so careful to make him feel involved."
"He is involved," I said, and started back toward Butters's makeshift examination table.
"Of course it hurts," Thomas was saying.
Butters was stitching up a small, puckered hole in his lower abdomen.
"But not as much as it did before you got the bullet out."
"And you're sure you can handle care this crude?"
Butters asked.
"Because if you were a regular human being, I could pretty much guarantee you that this thing would go septic in a couple of days and kill you."
"Microorganisms aren't a problem to my kind," Thomas said. "As long as I don't bleed out, I'll be fine."
My brother's tone was calm, but the color of his eyes had changed, growing lighter, a shade of fine gray with almost no blue at all in it. A vampire of the White Court had superhuman strength and speed and resilience, but not an infinite supply. Thomas's eyes changed as his personal demon, his hunger, gained more influence over his actions. At some point, he would need to feed to replenish himself.
"You about done?" I asked him. "I need the table."
"What is it with you people?" Butters groused. "For God's sake, these are real injuries here."
"There will be more of them than 1,000 reluctant physicians could patch up if we don't get moving," I said. "Today's serious business, man."
"How serious?"
"I can't think when it's been grimmer," I said. "Freaking waste of space vampires lying around on tables you need to use."
"Useless wizards," Thomas said, "jumping on enemy guns and accidentally shooting their allies with them."
"Oh," I said. "That was when I jumped Ace?"
He snorted. "Yeah."
I winced. "Ah, sorry about that."
"One of these days, Dresden," Thomas drawled. "Pow, right in the kisser."
"Talk is cheap," I said. "Table, table, table." Butters finished patching Thomas up, wrapping a long strip of gauze bandage around his middle. Thomas leaned back on his elbows as the doctor worked. The pose made his muscles stand out sharply beneath pale skin. But then most poses seemed to do that with Thomas. His pale eyes lingered on Molly for a long moment, and my apprentice abruptly turned away with spots of color high up in her cheeks.
Molly said. "Wow."
"Thomas," I said.
"Sorry," he said. He didn't sound sincere. He got up off the table with lazy grace.
"Say, Harry, do you have any more shirts back there? I bled, nobly and sacrificially, all over mine."
"They're Molly's," I said.
He looked at my apprentice.
"Oh?
What do I have to do to get one?"
"Go ahead," Molly said. Her voice was not quite a squeak. "Take one."
"Appreciate it," Thomas said, and sauntered into the spare bedroom.
Murphy watched him walk by, openly, then gave me a rather challenging look.
"What?" she asked. "He's pretty."
I heard that, Thomas said from the other room.
Map, I said, and Molly hurried over to the table.
Butters got his stuff off of it in rapid order. He'd evidently pulled the slug out of Thomas's guts without making a horrible bloody mess of things. The bullet had to have been close to the surface. Ace's gun must have been fairly lightweight, a 25 or a 22. Maybe he'd been using cheap ammo and the round had been short on powder. Or maybe Thomas's super abs had stopped the bullet before it could sink in. After the table was clean, Molly spread the map out on it. It was a map of Lake Michigan and the shores around it, including Chicago and Milwaukee and on up to Green Bay. Molly passed me a pen, and I leaned over and started making marks on the map with my swollen fingers. It hurt, but I ignored it. Karen got up and came over to watch. Thomas joined us a moment later, freshly attired in a plain white T-shirt, which looked like it had been made to fit him. He's a jerk like that. "What I'm doing here," I said, "is marking out all the nodes I remember."
"Nodes?" Butters asked.
My clumsy fingers made it a little hard to put the marks exactly where I wanted them. "The meeting points of one or more ley lines," I said. "I got to know all about them a few years ago."
"Those are like magical power cables, right?" Karen asked.
"More or less," I said. "Sources of power that you can draw on to make major magic. And there are a lot of them in the Great Lakes region. I'm drawing from memory, but I'm pretty sure these are right."
"They are,"
Molly confirmed quietly.
"Auntie Leah taught them to me a few months ago."
I looked up at her, eyed my battered fingers, and said, "Then why am I doing this?" Molly rolled her eyes and took the pen. She started marking nodes rapidly and precisely on the map, including the well on Demon Reach, though the island didn't appear on the map. "Whoever is going to attempt the spell on Demon Reach has to do it from somewhere near the shore of the lake," I said. "They're almost certainly going to be at one of these nodes. The closer to the edge of the lake, the better." I pointed out several nodes near the shore. "So we need to send the guard out to check these six locations near the edge of the lake first. After that, they go after the next nearest, and so on."
"Some of those are a good way off," Karen noted. "How fast can these little guys move?"
"Fast," I said. "Faster than anyone gives them credit. They can fly, and they can take shortcuts through the never-never. They can get to the sights and back before sundown." Sundown, which was when the big, bad immortals would come out to play. "Any questions so far?" I asked, looking at Murphy. She jerked her chin toward my brother and said, "Thomas filled me in." "Good," I said. "Exposition gets repetitive fast. A spell like this takes time to set up, and they won't really be able to hide it if we can get eyes on the site. Once we know which of the sites shows signs of use, we can get to it and thwart whatever lunatic is using it."
"Do we know who it is yet?" Murphy asked.
"Answer unclear," I said. "It's got to be those outsiders, right?" Thomas asked. "Stands to reason, but the real question is, who is helping them?" I got a bunch of looks at that. "Outsiders can't just show up in our reality," I said. "That's why they're called outsiders in the first place. Someone has to open the door and let them in." I took a deep breath. Which brings me to the next twist. I talked to Lily and Maeve, and they tell me that Mab is the one planning to tinker with the island. Silence followed that.
"That's a lie, right?"
Butters asked. "They can't lie," I said. "They physically can't. And yes, I got them to speak directly about it. There's no confusion of signals, no room for obfuscation." Thomas whistled quietly.
"Yeah," I said.
Molly said, "we're up against Mab, your boss?"
"Not necessarily," I said. "Lily and Maeve may not be lying, but they could still be wrong. Lily has never been a cerebral titan. And Maeve is, maybe insane is the only word that really describes it, but she's definitely firing on an odd number of cylinders. It's possible that they've been deceived."
"Or," Thomas said, "maybe they haven't."
"Or maybe they haven't," I said, nodding.
"What would that mean?" Molly asked.
"It would mean," Karen said quietly,
that Mab sent Harry to kill Maeve because either she wanted Maeve out of the way or she wanted Harry out of the way. Which is good, because it means that she's worried that there's someone who could stop her.
Right, I said.
Or maybe... I frowned, studying a new thought.
What? Thomas asked.
I looked slowly around the room. If Mab had been taken by the contagion, which really needed a better name, that certainly meant that Leah had been taken as well, and Leah had been tutoring Molly. If it had spread into the White Court, my brother could have been exposed. Murphy was maybe the most vulnerable. She was isolated, and her behavior had changed radically over the past couple of years. Hell, Butters was the person in the room least likely to have been exposed or turned or whatever, which made him the most ideal candidate for being turned. Paranoia. Because why should the conspiracy theorists get to have all the fun? I just couldn't see any of these people turning on me, no matter the influence. But if you could see treachery coming all that easily, Julius Caesar might have lived to a ripe old age. I'd always been slightly inclined to the paranoid. I had a sinking feeling I was going to start developing my latent potential. I picked my words very carefully. Over the past several years, I said, there have been several conflicts between two different interests. Several times, events have been driven by internal conflicts within one or both of those interests.
Like what? Butters asked.
Dual interests inside the Red Court, for one, I said. One of them trying to prevent conflict with the White Council, one of them trying to stir it up. Multiple houses of the White Court rising up to vie for control of it. The Winter and Summer Courts posturing and interfering with each other when Winter's territory was violated by the Red Court. I didn't want to get any more specific than that. Do you guys see what I'm getting at here?
Oh, Butter said. It's a phantom menace.
Ah, Molly said.
Thomas grunted. Karen glanced around at all of us and then said, Translate that from nerd to English, please. Someone is out there, I said. Someone who has been manipulating events, playing puppet master, stirring the pot, stacking the deck.
Mixing metaphors, Thomas suggested.
Fuck off. I'm just saying that this situation has the same shape as the others. Mab and Maeve at each other's throats, with Summer standing by ready to get involved, and outsiders starting to throw their weight around.
The Black Council, Molly whispered.
Exactly, I said, which it wasn't. Up until earlier today, I had known someone was covertly causing the world a lot of grief, and due to their connections with some grim events within the White Council, I had assumed it was a group of wizards, which was both naturally arrogant and extremely nearsighted of me. But what if I'd been wrong? What if the Black Council was just one more offshoot of one enormous, intangible enemy? If what I'd gotten from Lily was accurate, the problem was a hell of a lot bigger than I had realized. And I did not want that problem to know that I had spotted it. The Black Council, I said. A group of practitioners using dark magic to influence various events around the world. They're powerful, they're bad news. And if I'm right, they're here. If they're here, I figure it's a good bet that Sharkface and his chums...
Shark, Butters said. Chums. Funny.
Thank you for noticing, I said, and continued the sentence. Are working for the Black Council.
The theoretical Black Council, Karen said.
They're out there, definitely, I said.
Karen smiled faintly.
If you say so, Mulder.
I'm going to ignore that. The only question is whether or not they're here now.
Molly nodded seriously.
If they are, how do we find them?
We don't, I said. There isn't enough time to go sniffing around methodically. We know someone's going to mess with the island. It doesn't really matter who's pressing the button that sets off the bomb. We just have to keep it from getting pressed. The little folk find us that ritual site, and then we go wreck it.
Butters said. Not that I lack confidence in you guys, but shouldn't we be calling in the cavalry? I mean, doesn't that make more sense?
We are the cavalry, I said in a flat tone. The White Council won't help. Even if I knew the current protocols to contact them, it would take them days to verify that I am, in fact, alive and still me, and we only have hours. Besides, Molly's on their most wanted list. I didn't add in the third reason not to contact the Council. When they found out about my relationship with Mab, the monarch of a sovereign and occasionally hostile supernatural nation, they would almost certainly panic and assume that I was a massive security risk, which would, for a variety of reasons and to a variety of degrees, be an accurate assumption. And now that I thought about it, given how my induction had been psychically broadcast to all of Faerie, there was no chance whatsoever that the Council didn't know. Knowing stuff is what they do. Butters frowned.
The Paranetters?
No, I said. The last thing we need is a small army of newbies floundering around and stumbling into us. That's asking for trouble in the short term, the long term, and every other term there might be. We can go to them for information only. We aren't dragging them in. The little Emmy took off his glasses and cleaned them absently with the hem of his scrubs.
What about Lara's team, or the Einherjarin?
Thomas shrugged. I could probably convince Lara to send the team somewhere.
Ditto, Karen said. Only with Vikings.
Good, I said. We might need more bodies, and we might need to cover multiple sites. Can you two get that lined up when we break? They nodded. Molly, I said, you'll take the map up to our little scouts and tell them where to look and what to look for. Keep it simple, and promise an entire pizza to whoever finds what we're after. My apprentice grinned. Drive their performance with competition, huh? Millions of abusively obsessed sports parents can't be wrong, I said. Butters, you'll go to the Paranetters, and ask if anyone's seen or heard anything unusual anywhere even close to Lake Michigan. No one investigates anything. They just report. Get me all the information you can about any odd activity in the past week. We need to collect data as quickly as possible.
Right, Butters said. I've got some now, if you want.
I blinked. I mean, I knew the internet was the fast way to spread information, but...
Seriously? Well, Butters hedged, sort of. One of our guys is a little, imaginative.
You mean paranoid?
Yes, Butters said. He's got this internet lair in his mother's basement, keeps track of all kinds of things, calls it observing the supernatural through statistics. Sends me a regional status update every day, and my spam blockers just cannot keep him out.
Huh, I said, as if I knew what a spam blocker was. What's he got to say about today?
That boat rentals this morning were 400% higher today than the median for this time of year, and dark forces are bound to be at work.
Boat rentals, I muttered.
He's a little weird, Harry, Butters said. I mean, he has a little headshot photo tree of the people responsible for the Cubs' billy goat curse. That kind of odd. He blows the curve.
Tell him to take the tree down. The billy goat curse was a lone gunman, I said. But paranoid doesn't necessarily equal wrong. Boats. I bowed my head and closed my eyes for a moment, thinking. But if Butters's paranoid basement freak was right, then the puzzle piece he'd handed me was woefully unhelpful. I needed more pieces. Okay, I said. Right, get more data. I looked up, jerked my head at Thomas, and headed for the kitchen. Let's go talk to our guest about his boss. I leaned down to look into the oven through the glass door. There was no light inside, but I could make out Captain Hook's armored form huddled disconsolately on a coated cookie sheet. I knocked on the glass, and Captain Hook's helmet turned toward me.
I want to talk to you, I said. You're my prisoner. Don't try to fight me or run away, or I'll have to stop you. I'd rather just have a nice conversation. Do you understand me?
Hook didn't give me any indications either way. I took silence as assent.
Okay, I said. I'm going to open the door now.
I cracked open the oven door and opened it slowly, doing my best not to loom. Tough to do when you're the size of a building relative to the person over whom you are standing. Now, just take it easy, and we will... I'd opened the door maybe 6 inches when Captain Hook all but vanished in a blur of speed. I swiped an arm at him about a second and a half too late, but I didn't feel too bad about missing, because Thomas tried to snatch the little maniac too and missed completely. Hook, who worked for our enemies, and who had been right there in the kitchen the whole time we'd been scheming, shot toward a vent on one wall, crossing the room in the blink of an eye, and none of us could react in time to stop him. Chapter 29. None of us but the Major General. Toot dropped down from where he'd been crouched atop a bookcase, intercepting Hook's darting black form, and tackled the other little fairy to the floor in the middle of the living room. They landed with a thump on the carpeting, wings still blurring in fits and starts, and tumbled around the floor in irregular bursts and hops, sometimes rolling a few inches, sometimes bounding up and coming down 6 feet away. Toot had planned for this fight. He'd tackled Hook into the carpet, where the hooks on his armor would get tangled and bind him, slowing him down. Furthermore, Toot's hands were wrapped in cloth until it looked like he was wearing mittens or boxing gloves, and he managed to seize Hook by the hooks on the back of his armor. He swung the other little fairy around in a circle and then, with a high-pitched shout, flung him into the wall. Captain Hook slammed into the wall, putting gouges in the freshly painted drywall, then staggered back and fell to the ground. Toot bore down with a vengeance, drawing his little sword, and the armored figure held up a mailed fist.
"Invocation!"
he piped in a high, clear voice.
"I am a prisoner! I invoke winter law!"
Toot's sword was already in mid-swing, but at those last two words he checked himself abruptly, pulling the weapon back. He hovered there over Hook with his feet an inch off the ground, gritting his teeth, but then he buzzed back from Hook and sheathed the sword.
I said, "Toot, what just happened?"
Toot Toot landed on the kitchen counter next to me and stomped around in a circle, clearly furious.
"You opened your big fat mouth,"
he screamed. After a moment, he added sullenly,
"My lord."
I frowned at Toot and then at Hook. The enemy sprite just sat there on the floor, making no further effort to escape.
"Okay," I said, "explain that."
"You offered to take him prisoner,"
Toot said.
"By winter law, if he accepts your offer, he may not attempt escape or offer any further resistance to you for as long as you see to his needs. Now you can't kill him or beat him up or anything. And I was winning."
I blinked.
"Yeah, okay, fine. So let's make with the questions already."
"You can't,"
Toot wailed.
"You can't try to make him betray his previous covenants or interrogate him or anything."
I frowned. "Wait, he's a guest?"
"Yes."
"By winter law?" I asked.
"Yes, sort of."
"Well," I said, starting toward Hook, "I never signed on to that treaty, so screw winter law." And abruptly, as if someone had just slammed a row of staples into my skin, the mantle of the winter night vanished completely. Pain soared back into my body, inflamed tissue crying out, my bruises throbbing, the edemas beneath my skin pounding with horrible tightness. Fatigue hit me like a truck. The sensations were so intense, the only way I could tell that I had fallen to the floor was by looking. And my body abruptly went numb and useless from my stomach down. That scared the hell out of me and confirmed one of my worst fears. When I'd consented to serve Mab, my back had been broken. My spine damaged. Taking up the mantle had covered what would probably have been a crippling and long-term injury. But without it, my body was only mortal. Better than most at recovering over time, but still human. Without the mantle, I wouldn't have legs, bladder or bowel control, or, most important, independence. I was on the ground like that for a subjective week, but it could have been only a few seconds before Thomas reached my side with Murphy, Butters, and Molly right behind him. I knew they were there because I could see them, but their voices swam down to me from what seemed like a great distance amongst the cacophony of raking sensations scouring my nervous system. They lifted me to a sitting position, and then abruptly the pain was gone, and my legs started moving again, jerking in a single gentle spasm. The mantle had been restored.
"Okay," I said in a ragged voice. Maybe we won't screw Winter Law."
"Harry," Thomas said, as if he'd said my name several times already. "What happened?"
I said, "I think it's a side effect. Fallout from defying the order of things."
"What?" he asked.
"Fairies," I said. "They're kind of insane and mischievous and dangerous as hell, but they all share one trait. They're good to their word. They obey what they recognize as law, especially Mab."
"You aren't making much sense right now," Thomas said.
"The mantle of power comes from Mab, and now it's in me, but it's still a piece of her. If I go violating her own realm's laws, it looks like the mantle isn't going to have my back."
"Meaning what?"
"Meaning I better figure out what the laws are pretty damn quick," I replied. "Help me up."
Thomas hauled me to my feet, and I looked at Toot. "You know the Winter Law?"
"Well,"
Toot said as if I were an idiot.
"Of course."
"Where can I learn it?" Toot tilted his head.
"What?"
"Winter Law," I said. "Where can I learn it?"
"I don't understand,"
Toot said, tilting his head the other way.
"Oh, for the love of—"
I pinched the bridge of my nose between my thumb and forefinger.
"Toot, can you read?"
"Sure," Toot said. "I can read pizza and exit and chocolate."
"All three, huh?"
"Absolutely."
"You're a scholar and a gentleman," I said. "But where did you learn Winter Law?"
Toot shook his head as if mystified.
"You don't learn it, Harry. You just know it. Everyone knows it."
"I don't," I said.
"Maybe you're too big," Toot said. "Or too loud. Or, you know, too human."
I grunted. Then I eyed Hook, who had continued to sit in the same spot during the entire conversation. "So I've gone and made him my guest, eh?"
"Well, more like your vassal."
I frowned. What?
"That's what surrender is, duh,"
Toot said.
"His life is yours to do with, as you please. And as long as you don't starve him or make him an oath-breaker, you can tell him to do whatever you want. And if his liege wants him back, he has to pay you for him."
"Huh. Medieval-style ransom." Toot looked confused.
"He did run some, but I stopped him, my lord. Like, just now, in front of you, right over there."
There were several conspicuous sounds behind me, the loudest from my apprentice, and I turned to eye everyone else. They were all either covering smiles or holding them back, poorly. "Hey, Peanut Gallery," I said, "this isn't as easy as I'm making it look."
"You're doing fine," Karen said, her eyes twinkling.
I sighed. "Come on, Toot," I said, and walked over to Hook. The little fairy sat there, apparently ignoring me, which took considerable nerve. If I fell or stepped on him, it would be like a tree falling on a lumberjack. If I were trying to hurt him, physically, I could twist him up like Stretch Armstrong. On the other hand, Hook was a fairy. It probably never even occurred to him that I might violate Mab's laws.
"The prisoner will stand and face the Tsar Lord,"
Toot shrilled. Hook obediently got up and turned to face me. "Identify yourself, please," I said. "I don't want your name, just something to call you."
"By some I am called Lacuna," he replied.
"Suits me, Lacuna," I said. "Remove the helmet, please. I want to see who I'm supporting." Lacuna reached up and removed the face-shrouding helmet. She was gorgeous.
Cobweb-fine black hair bound into a braid at least a foot long spilled down out of the helmet when she did. Her skin was paper-white, her huge eyes black all the way through. There were small markings or tattoos of some kind in deep purple ink on her skin, but they shifted slightly as I watched, some fading from sight, others appearing. Her features were long and very lean. She had a straight razor's elegant, dangerous beauty. Toot's jaw just about dropped off of his head.
Wow!
Karen said. That's the one who beat you up last night, is it?
And tripped him this morning, Thomas reminded her.
And tripped me this morning, I growled.
I turned back to Lacuna and studied her for a moment. She looked back at me without blinking. Actually, she didn't move at all, except for her braid, which drifted upward like cobwebs over a heating vent.
Huh, I said. Was not expecting that.
Lacuna stared, her eyes flat.
I won't ask you to break your word, I told her, and I will treat you with respect and provide for your needs in exchange for your service. Do you understand?
I understand,
Lacuna said.
Wow,
said Toot. Without breaking any oath, I would like to know, I said, whatever you can tell me about the person you were serving until you were taken prisoner. She stared.
I caught my mistake and rolled my eyes.
Let me rephrase that.
Tell me whatever you can about the person you were serving until you were taken prisoner without breaking any word you've given him. Lacuna nodded at that and frowned pensively. Then she looked up and said in a serious, confidential tone,
He does not seem to like you very much.
I took a slow, deep breath. There were more titters behind me.
I noticed that too, I said. Tell me what you know about what's happening tonight.
Children,
she said in a sepulchral voice, and her little face twisted up with unmistakable fury.
And candy. Lots and lots of candy.
Wow,
Toot said. He zipped away in a flutter of wings.
Without breaking your word, tell me everything else you know about Ace, I said.
He owes me,
Lacuna replied grimly,
for services rendered.
I sighed.
I don't suppose you'd like to volunteer to offer me some more useful information?
The armored fairy stared at me without blinking. It was a little creepy.
Nah, I didn't think so, I said.
Are you hungry?
She seemed to consider that for a moment, then said,
Yes.
Do you want some pizza? Lacuna's face twisted up in disgust.
No!
My eyebrows went up. That was a grade A first. The little folk would quite literally go to war over pizza. They liked it that much. What would you like to eat, then?
Celery,
she replied promptly.
Cheese, green tea, but mostly celery.
How random, I said. I looked over my shoulder. Molly?
I've got those, she said, and went to the kitchen.
Okay, Lacuna, I said. We've got a bunch of business to take care of. I want you to eat, get some rest, and make yourself comfortable. You aren't to leave this apartment, understood? Lacuna nodded somberly.
Yes.
Her wings blurred, and she darted across the apartment to the kitchen, where Molly was preparing a plate with Lacuna chow on it.
Good. I'll figure out what to do with you later.
I rubbed the back of my neck and went back over to the others.
Well, that was a little frustrating.
Why'd you take her prisoner, then? Thomas asked. I glowered at him.
Don't you have a squad of mercenaries to round up, or a bridge to jump off?
I guess so.
Okay, everybody, I said. You've got your assignments. Let's get them done. Molly, you've got the apartment and the phone, so after you send the search parties, you're coordinating. Anyone learn something, call Molly with it. Otherwise, meet back here by 5.
There was a round of nods and agreements, and Butters, Thomas, and Karen headed out into the city. Once they were gone, Molly asked, Why'd you ditch them like that? I lifted my eyebrows again.
The grasshopper just kept getting cleverer. I wasn't ditching them, I said.
Molly arched an eyebrow.
You weren't?
Not entirely, I said. That stuff needs doing, too.
Well, you go somewhere dangerous all by yourself. Am I right?
I didn't answer her right away, and she finished making Lacuna's meal. She put the plate on the counter, and the serious little fairy fell upon it like a ravening wolf. Something like that, I said. Don't you have a job to do, too? Molly eyed me. Then she picked up the map on the table, folded it, and walked toward the door.
I'm not going to fight you about it. I just wanted you to know that I knew.
Just then, Toot buzzed back into the apartment from somewhere. He buzzed in frantic, dizzying circles, starting at the point he'd last seen Lacuna, until his spiral search pattern took him to the kitchen. Then he swooped down to Lacuna, landing neatly on the counter. I peered at the two little fairies. Toot held out to Lacuna a wrapped watermelon Jolly Rancher, as if he were offering frankincense and myrrh to the Christ child.
"Hi," he said brightly. "I'm Major General Toot Toot."
Lacuna looked up from her food and saw Toot's gift. Her eyes narrowed. And then she sucker-punched Toot Toot right in the face. My little bodyguard flew back a couple of feet and landed on his ass. Both of his hands went up to his nose, and he blinked in startled bewilderment. Toot had dropped the Jolly Rancher. Lacuna calmly kicked it into the disposal drain of the kitchen sink. Then she turned her back on Toot, ignoring him completely, and went back to eating her meal. Toot's eyes were even wider as he stared at Lacuna.
"Wow," he said.
Chapter 30. The Montrose Point Bird Sanctuary has a second name, the Magic Hedge. There are about 15 acres of trees, brush, and winding trails. It's been an established bird sanctuary for decades, and is a major port of call for birds migrating south for the winter. If you read some flyers about the place, they'll tell you all about how the Magic Hedge is chock-full to bursting with the magic of birds and nature. But the folks who live here also call it the Magic Hedge because it's a fairly well-known hangout for men who are hoping to hook up with other men. The ratio of cruisers to bird watchers, and don't think I didn't consider it an ironic joke about binoculars and watching birds, varies depending on the time of the year. When there are tons of birds and bird lovers around, that means lots of people with binoculars and cameras. That kind of thing really cuts down on the romantic mystique. The place sticks out like a hook, almost totally enclosing Montrose Harbor, which is mostly a place for boats that are a lot less grubby than the water beetle. There's a yacht club in there and a fairly busy beach nearby, so occasionally non-bird-watching, non-cruising people wander through the Magic Hedge, too. People like me. At the end of October, most of the migrating flocks had already gone by, but the hedge was still a rendezvous for leftover flocks of sparrows, which would gather together over a few days, then merge and leave in an enormous cloud. I spotted 2 dozen species on my walk in, without binoculars. I knew most of them. If I had bothered to dig their names out of my memories, I didn't. Ebenezer, when he taught me, had been very serious about making sure I learned the proper names of things. The park was mostly empty today, under the cold gray drizzling sky. On the way in to where I wanted to go, I passed a man dressed all in black, with a black hat and black sunglasses. Sunglasses, for crying out loud, who tracked me with his needlessly cool gaze as I went by. "Not here for that," I said. "Making a long-distance call. Be gone in half an hour, one way or another." He didn't say anything, and as I passed, he faded back into the brush. There's a community here. Spotters, runners. The police run stings sometimes. Seems like an awful lot of fuss and trouble for everyone involved to me, especially in the modern world. Bob wasn't in my shoulder bag anymore, but I'd replaced him with what I'd need. The lake nearby and the falling rain would do for water. Earth was there in plenty, and I used a garden spade to dig a small pit. The fitful cold winds from the northwest would do for air, and once I got the few pounds of kindling I brought piled into a small hollow pyramid, it didn't take me long to get a tiny fire going, even in the rain. I waited until it had begun to blaze up, building it to make it burn hotter and faster. I didn't want to cook on it. A few minutes were all I needed. I stayed low and moved as little as possible. A song from hundreds of gathered sparrows was enthusiastic, pervasive. Once the fire was burning, I used a trowel to cut a circle into the soft earth around me. I touched it with my finger and invested a minor effort of will, and the magic of the circle snapped up around me. It was a mystic barrier, not a physical one, something that would contain and focus magical forces, and generally make it easier to do what I was about to do. It couldn't be seen or touched, but it was very, very real. A lot of important things are like that. I gathered my will, sinking into pure focus. People think wizards use magic words for some reason. There aren't any magic words, really. Even the ones we use in our spells are just symbols, a way to insulate our minds from the energies coursing through them. Words have a power every bit as terrible and beautiful as magic, and they don't need a special effects budget to do it, either. What drives magic is, at the end of the day, sheer will. Emotions can help reinforce it, but when you draw on your emotions to fuel magic, even that is simply a different expression of will, a different flavor of your desire to make something happen. Some things you do as a wizard require you to set any emotion you have aside. They're good in a crisis, but in a methodical, deliberate effort, they can wreak havoc with your intentions. So I blocked out all my confusion, doubt, and uncertainty, along with my perfectly intelligent terror, until all that remained was my rational self and my need to reach a single goal. Only then did I lift my head and speak, infusing every word with the power of my need, casting the summoning forth into the universe. The power made my voice sound strange, louder, deeper, richer.
Lady of light and life, hear me. Thou who art queen of the evergreen, lady of flowers, hear me. Dire portents are afoot. Hear my voice. Hear my need. I am Harry Dresden, winter night, and thy needs must speak with thee.
I lifted my joined voice and will and thundered,
Titania, 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 I summon thee.
The last syllable rebounded from every surface in sight with booming echoes. It panicked the sparrows. They flew up in a cloud of thousands of wings and little bodies, gathering in a swarm that raced wildly in circles around the meadow.
Come on, I breathed to myself. Come on already.
I stood in silence for a long, long minute, and I was starting to think that nothing was going to happen. And then I saw the clouds begin to rotate, and I knew exactly what it meant. I've lived in the Midwest for most of my life. Tornadoes are a fact of life out here, part of the background. People think they're scary, and they are, but they're very survivable provided you follow some fairly simple guidelines. Warn people early, and when you hear the warning, head for the safest space you can reach quickly. That's usually a basement or root cellar. Sometimes it's beneath a staircase. Sometimes it's in an interior bathroom. Sometimes the best you can hope for is the deepest ditch you can find. But basically it all amounts to run and hide. Years of life in the Midwest screamed at me to do exactly that. My heart started speeding up and my mouth went dry, while the clouds overhead, and when I say overhead, I mean directly over my head, turned faster and faster. Birds exploded into the sky from all over the magic hedge, joining the sparrows in their wild circling. The air suddenly became close, and the drizzling rain cut off as if a valve had been closed. Lightning with no thunder flickered weirdly through the clouds, which turned every shade of white and blue and sea green as the water vapor separated the light into the visible spectrum. Then I felt it. A warmth like that I'd felt in Lily, only 100 times hotter and brighter and more intense. The clouds started to lower, and the frantic birds tightened their circle, until they were a wall of shining feathers and glittering eyes around the meadow.
Then there was a flash of light, a toll of thunder that sounded weirdly musical, like the aftertone of some vast gong, and a shower of earth and glowing bits of charred autumn grass flew into the air. I threw up an arm to shield my eyes, but I kept my feet planted. When the dirt settled and the dust and the ash cleared, the Lady of Light and Life and Monarch of the Summer Court stood about 15 feet away from me. She was breathtaking. I don't mean beautiful, because she was that, obviously. But it was the kind of beauty that had so much scope, so much depth, so much power that it made me feel dwindling, insignificant, and very, very temporary. You feel it the first time you see the mountains, the first time you see the sea, the first time you see the vast, bleak majesty of the Grand Canyon, and every single time you look at Titania, the Summer Queen. I'd say that the details of her appearance were unimportant, except that they weren't, particularly for me. Titania was dressed for a fight. She wore a gown of mail made from some kind of silvery metal, the links so fine that at first it looked like woven cloth. It covered her like a second skin, all the way to the top of her throat. Over that she wore a long robe of silk that shifted in colors from the yellow of sunlight to the green of pine needles in a slow, strobe-like pattern. Her silver-white hair had been braided into a tail and then fixed in coils at the base of her neck. Upon her head was a crown of what looked like twisted vine with still living leaves. She carried neither weapon nor shield, but her wide she-eyes stared at me with the absolute certainty of one who knows she is armed well beyond the ability of her enemy to withstand. Oh, and if I hadn't known better, I would have sworn to you that it was Mab standing there. Seriously, they didn't look like sisters. They looked like clones. I started off by bowing to her deeply. I held it for a beat before rising again. She was a statue for a few seconds. She didn't so much as nod back to me, to any measurable degree, but some micro-change in her body language indicated acknowledgement. "You who slew my daughter," Titania said quietly. "You dare summon me?" The last word slashed through the air, its fury palpable. It struck the circle surrounding me and broke into a shower of gold and green sparks that vanished almost instantly. I've had some experience with the queens of faerie. When they get angry and start talking to you, you freaking hear them. And then, if you survive it, you hope you can make it to the emergency room in time. I just hadn't seen any scenario in which my talking to Titania wouldn't make her furious, so I'd drawn the circle as a precaution. Sometimes I use my brain. "Crazy, right?" I said. "But I needed to speak to you, O Queen." Her eyes narrowed. The curtain cloud of birds continued their circling around us, though they had fallen eerily silent. The clouds overhead continued to spin. We were as isolated from the rest of the world as if we stood in a private garden. "Speak, then." I thought about my words and picked them carefully. "There are events in motion, very large events, with serious ramifications for basically the whole world. I mean, I thought the war between the White Council and the Red Court was a big deal, but now it looks to me like it was more or less an opening act for the real band." Her eyes narrowed. She nodded her head a fraction of an inch. "Something is going to happen tonight," I said. "The well will come under attack. You know what could happen if it is opened. A lot of people would get hurt in the short term, and in the long term, well, I'm not sure I know what would happen, but I'm almost certain it wouldn't be good." Titania tilted her head slightly to one side. It reminded me of an eagle considering its prey and deciding whether or not it was worth it to swoop down on it out of nowhere. "I'm trying to make sure that doesn't happen," I said. "And because of the nature of this problem,
I can't trust any of the information I get out of the people I'm working for. Ah, she said. You wish me to pass judgment upon my sister. I need someone with knowledge of Mab, I said. Someone who knows the events are in motion